All right. This is Victor Pinicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is June 16, 2010. The time is approximately 3:10 p.m. I'm accompanied by Brad Bondi, Karen Dubas, Ron Borzakowski of the commission, and Josh Silver. We're at NCRC's offices, thank you, for the interview of Mr. Silver. The interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Silver. Mr. Silver, if I could get your verbal assent to that on the record.
I agree.
All right. At the conclusion of this, will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record and spell your last name for the transcriptionist. In the way of background, the FCIC was established by statute, Public Law 111-21, and signed into law by the President. It is bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by 15 December 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed if you so desire. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code Section 1001 concerning false statements. If everybody would, I'll start with my last name, Cunicelli, C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I.
Ron Borzakowski, B as in boy, O-R-Z-E-K-O-W-S-K-I.
Brad Bondi, B-O-N-D-I.
Karen Dubas, D-U-B-A-S.
Josh Silver, as in silver and gold, S-I-L-V-E-R.
Okay. Just real briefly, Mr. Silver, if you would, just recall that we're recording, if you can, if you say a proper name, please spell it the first time, or just make sure that all your responses are verbal and audible. All right.
Okay.
Mr. Silver, thank you for agreeing to be interviewed today. I know you've met with our staff and talked with us a number of times, so we wanted to follow up on a couple questions that we had, primarily from the September 2007 annual report on CRA commitments. We've heard your background before, so I'm going to dispense with the background type questions and get to some of the meat of our follow up questions. Throughout the annual report, there's several references to CRA commitments, agreements, and unilateral agreements. If you could you just define for us what's meant by a CRA commitment versus a voluntary agreement versus a unilateral agreement?
Okay. Well, you also asked, Brad, this report that you have called CRA Commitments was released in September 2007, and you asked about updates. Mm-hmm. And one reason it hasn't been updated is CRA agreements are harder to come by. For example, after this report, in April 2008, Bank of America issued what we call a unilateral commitment. A CRA agreement is actually a document that is signed, oftentimes signed by the community organization and the bank. One of our members, New Jersey Citizen Action, actually has a template for a CRA agreement. They are not successful in getting all of the provisions all the time, but I give you the template. And you can actually see that this is an agreement between New Jersey Citizen Action and the bank. So you have that.
Thank you.
Sometimes it takes the form of a memorandum of understanding. This is a memorandum of understanding between J.P. Morgan Chase and the Chicago CRA Coalition, which is headed up by one of our members called the Woodstock Institute. So this is, I have that for you as well, and we can go through the specific provisions if you're interested. Some of it actually requires some technical explanation. More recently, the phenomena has been, and by the way, this is all voluntary, whether it's an agreement or a unilateral commitment, because there's nothing in the CRA regulation that requires CRA agreements. And actually, the regulatory agencies always remind all the stakeholders that is the case. This is all voluntary activity. The recent trend, and I'll give you an example of this, is what we call unilateral commitment. In April of 2008, Bank of America issued a $1.5 trillion, basically a unilateral commitment. It was in the process of acquiring Countrywide, and I have the press release describing the $1.5 trillion commitment over 10 years. It sounds very laudable, but the difficulty with these unilateral commitments, often from a community perspective, is you don't know what geographies it covers. You don't know the exact definition of low and moderate income that they're using. And, you know, Bank of America is a trillion-dollar institution, whereas $1 trillion over 10 years sounds impressive. If you actually look at the last few years of loan lending, oftentimes the commitment is not actually much more than what they're already doing when you look at their previous year's loan volumes. Nevertheless, you know, there are elements of these unilateral commitments that we, you know, we applaud. But also, I should say in this conversation that CRA agreements and commitments are much harder to come by. And more recently, I mean, there's lots of other things that are very important about CRA that I hope we have time to talk about.
Okay. I appreciate the definitions and distinctions. Let me follow up on one of the idea of the unilateral commitment. Does that mean that community groups and the NCRC is not involved in any way with the unilateral commitment, that there's no communications with the bank ahead of time?
Well, sometimes the bank will surprise people when they announce the unilateral commitment, but oftentimes there has been informal negotiations. A lot of the times when you have CRA agreements, it is occurring in the context of a merger application proceeding. In this case, Bank of America was acquiring Countrywide. So there have been a series of meetings with community organizations, and at these meetings, community organizations asked the banks to consider doing a CRA agreement, and the institutions kind of, you know, more recently haven't been forthcoming. And then a day or two before, if there's a public hearing on the meeting on the merger, a day or two before the public hearing, they'll drop a unilateral commitment. That's been sort of the trend more recently.
Well, why is that the trend now, unilateral commitments versus the written agreements? Why is that a trend? Why is that a recent phenomenon?
And actually, the more recent trend is, as you know, these mergers occur in waves. There was a lot of mergers around in mid-1998. I remember when I got married and I had a honeymoon in April of 1998, from the first couple weeks in April. And literally, I'm sitting there in Hawaii and you're turning on the TV almost every other day. Bank of America, I think it was then Bank of America was acquiring Nations. Oh, it was the other way around. Nations Bank was acquiring Bank of America. There was a couple of other two or three huge mergers in 2004. So 2004 was a big year. I mean, I'm sorry, 1998. Then 2004 was another big year. And then there's been a year. Then there's years where there's not a whole lot of merger activity. And then, of course, between 2004 and now, there was Wachovia took over World Savings, which actually turned out to be a big mistake for Wachovia. Because we know what happened with those option arms. And then really the most recent merger activity was these emergency mergers in the fall of 2008 when basically it was arranged by the regulatory agencies when these institutions were about to fail. J.P. Morgan Chase acquires Washington Mutual who acquires Wachovia? Wells Fargo acquires Wachovia. J.P. Morgan Chase acquires Bear Stearns. And in the middle of this, crisis, the industry actually got more concentrated because of these emergency mergers. That's not necessarily a good thing. So the reason I say all that is because really, from 2008 to now, there really hasn't been a whole lot of merger activity. That's the normal, usual merger activity. And consequently, there's been little opportunity to do any sort of CRA agreement or banks issuing unilateral agreements, because that's usually when CRA agreements were occurring, during the bank merger process. And since there hasn't really been, there's been very few mergers from 2008 to now, that's the usual normal merger, there's been very few opportunities for CRA agreements. And in 2008, we call these emergency mergers, it was not the usual process. It was not an application. There was not a public comment period. It was done in a matter of hours, if you recall. You know, you just looked in the website of the agencies and you were shocked that, you know, Washington Mutual has failed and now it's part of J.P. Morgan Chase. So now, the more recent trend is a dearth of CRA agreements. Before that, from about 2000, you know, it's hard to say, but, you know, probably 4 or 5 years, 2008, and then prior, it was kind of more these unilateral commitments. In the mid to late 1990s, that was kind of the time period where you had these negotiated CRA agreements. And, you know, at first, when CRA became more visible in the mid to late 1990s, because there was a reinvigoration of CRA, banks thought that doing CRA agreements would look good in terms of the public, in terms of the regulator. And then the regulator started saying, you know, you don't have to do these. They actually would write that in the merger approval orders, that CRA agreements is not required by the regulation. So then the banks sort of figured out, maybe we don't have to sign these documents. Maybe we just issue unilateral pledges. So you see that in 2008. Now, really, the way our community, our community organizations still try to work with banks and persuade them to offer safe and sound products that are needed for communities. Some of our members still pursue CRA agreements, but really the main ways now that community organizations seek to enforce CRA is commenting on CRA exams, commenting on merger applications when they occur, and then having regular discussions with banks, but, you know, not really expecting that they're going to get a CRA agreement, that they're just going to use the process of merger applications and commenting on exams and just also regular meetings with banks to, in an effort to increase safe and sound lending and investing in communities.
And now these comments with respect to merger applications, would they also be made by community groups in conjunction with requests for unilateral commitments or voluntary commitments for CRA mortgages, CRA loans?
Well, you will see, actually, if you look at the Bank of America and Countrywide proceeding, you can find the approval, the Federal Reserve approval orders on their webpage. I can actually show you where. But you will see a discussion that, you know, community organizations asked the bank to make a commitment. And then you'll see a footnote, but CRA agreements are not required by the regulation. So, you know, you'll see that, you know, yes, and when the community groups commented, sometimes they will say in the comments, we want the bank to make an agreement with Bank of America and Countrywide. An issue was making sure that loans were not abusive and were safe and sound. Are you willing to put in writing that you're going to have these due diligence procedures? And actually, you'll see in the J.P. Morgan Chase and Woodstock CRA Coalition Memorandum of Understanding, some anti-predatory lending safeguards. There has been criticism about CRA that CRA contributed to the subprime crisis. That is the exact opposite. I can show you a quote from Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, that in the Federal Reserve's experience, CRA was not the root of the crisis and did not contribute to the crisis. CRA requires safe and sound lending, and community groups have been interested in nothing but safe and sound lending for their communities. And you'll see, if we had a memorandum of understanding, for example, J.P. Morgan Chase's commitment to safe and sound and anti-predatory lending safeguards.
Let me break up some of the things you said. I appreciate the background here. First, with respect to the Bank of America Countrywide merger and the unilateral commitment, the $1.5 trillion over 10 years, this commitment, mm-hmm. Were there communications then between community groups and Bank of America leading up to this unilateral commitment?
Yes, as I said to you before, yes.
And what role did the Federal Reserve or the OCC play with respect to the unilateral commitment that Bank of America did?
Minimal to none. I think that I was not involved in any of these discussions, but I think these were meetings between the community organizations and the bank itself, and I don't think the regulators were present. The regulatory agencies know that trying to that community organizations do seek commitments from banks, and preferably in writing. So you'll see that in actually the Bank of America countrywide approval order, that such and such community organization commented during the merger proceeding that they would like to see a commitment from Bank of America, and then you'll see the footnote, but CRA agreement making is not part of the CRA regulation. So I think, to answer your question, to the best of my ability, that there was no involvement in the meetings between the community organizations and the banks by the Federal Reserve Board or the OCC in which CRA agreements were discussed. They were not at those meetings. But because community groups put comments on the record during the merger application, they were aware that community groups were seeking commitments for safe and sound and responsible lending and investing.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the 2007, September 2007, CRA commitments report by the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, on page 4, there is a statement in that report, if you look to the second paragraph, last mm-hmm. sentence, recognizing the important role of collaboration between lenders and community groups, the federal agencies have established mechanisms in their application procedures that encourage dialogue and cooperation among the parties in preserving and strengthening community reinvestment. And then there's mm-hmm. a footnote mm-hmm. that reads, the Federal Reserve Board will grant an extension of the public comment period during its merger application process upon a joint request by a bank and a community group. Mm-hmm. In its commentary to Regulation Y, the board indicates that this procedure was added to facilitate discussions between banks and community groups regarding programs that help serve the convenience and needs of the community. In its corporate manual, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency states that it will not offer the expedited application process to a lender that does not intend to honor a CRA agreement made by the institution that it is acquiring.
Mm-hmm.
Taking that sentence in the second paragraph that I just read and the footnote that mm-hmm. I just read, what sort of procedures are in place that the regulators can get involved to help facilitate or encourage CRA commitments?
I think that's Josh Silver wrote these paragraphs. So if you want to help, haul me off to jail. In the late 1990s, the federal agencies were reforming their merger application procedures. There was some controversy about these expedited procedures, mostly for smaller banks. So then to address the concerns of community organizations, we want more than 10 days to comment on a merger application, for example. And to facilitate collaboration between the community organization and the bank, the agencies adopted these procedures described in the footnote. The Federal Reserve will grant an extension of the public comment period if requested by the bank and the community group, which I think is a good thing. I don't think it's ever happened, not to my knowledge. I'm not involved in these meetings and negotiations between the banks and the community organizations because we empower our member organizations to do that work. I provide consultation and technical assistance, data analysis, interpreting laws and regulations. I think since mergers are very complex things and an institutional structure can be profoundly changed, it is very important for all stakeholders to think through the ramifications. Often what happens when banks get larger is you'll have CRA officers that are on the ground in Cleveland or Baltimore. And then if the bank is now going to be headquartered in San Francisco, will those CRA officers still have the same decision-making authority to do these very complex community development deals, whether it's low-income housing tax credits or equity investments in small businesses? And that's often a common concern, that when these institutions get very big, are now those kind of local CRA officers that had some decision-making power stripped away. And that has happened. So that's why it's very productive to think through some of these institutional changes before they occur, and to think if there's a way to make sure that the bank is able institutionally, because of its institutional structure, is the bank able to maintain its CRA performance in different localities. So if both the bank and community group says to the regulator, hey, we need some more time to figure out this very complicated matter, that's a positive thing, because it's a regulatory mechanism to make sure that a change is going to benefit all parties in society. I think it's a very positive thing that facilitates voluntary working through, you know, some very complicated issues and problems. Again, I don't think it's ever happened. And what I described in the corporate manual of the OCC, at least in the late 1990s, that's indeed what it was. It doesn't say that there's going to be any guaranteed solution. It just says we're going to take the application off the fast track if a bank goes into a community and says we're not going to honor the commitments done by its, you know, the institution that it's acquiring. But again, the only thing that the regulators are promising here is we will basically extend the process if we think it's mutually beneficial, but there's no commitments by the regulatory agency saying we're going to be involved in the process of the meetings between the banks and the community groups.
Mm-hmm. In the sentence, you talk about that federal agencies have established mechanisms in their application process. Aside from the two references in the footnote to the granting the extension by the Federal Reserve and Regulation Y, and then the corporate manual of the OCC, are there any other mechanisms that are established in the application procedures to encourage dialogue and cooperation by the parties in preserving and strengthening community reinvestment, as you've described here?
Well, what happens is people can submit written comments during the public comment period, and the agencies will occasionally ask questions of the bank. For example, in the late 1990s, a big concern was because banks were starting to buy actually subprime mortgage companies. Then would not be on the CRA exams of the banks. But you know, since the banks were buying some subprime mortgage companies, if an applicant walks into the subprime mortgage company and qualifies for the prime loan, do you have a referral up mechanism to give that person a prime loan? And actually, you'll see that in the Woodstock, you know, J.P. Morgan Memorandum of Understanding. So instead of, if you qualify for a 6% interest rate, you're going to get it rather than a 9% interest rate. You know, that could be tens of thousands of dollars over the course of a loan. You know, it's a very important issue. When the agencies see it, there is very important issues like this being raised, and very legitimate ones, they'll ask the bank. You know, community organizations have asked you about referral up programs. What are you going to do in response to those questions? And then the bank responds. And all of these comments and then the questions posed by the regulators and the response by the banks is a matter of public record. If you requested a copy of the bank application, you will get all this correspondence. Sometimes in big mergers, you can have, you know, boxes on your in your office that involves all this stuff. And this is all a very good thing because, you know, through dialogue and thinking these issues through, hopefully there are solutions that may not have even occurred to the bank before the process. But then, thanks to the process, the bank says, you know, that does make some sense. And, you know, then they'll put on a piece of paper, whether it's a CRA agreement or just, you know, a response to the question, what they're going to do about it. You know.
Now, Josh, help me understand. I mean, when I look through the annual report, and there's a lot of detail about the commitments that are made and the unilateral commitments and the voluntary agreements that are made, they all seem to be in connection with mergers or expansions or acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it, if it doesn't matter for purposes of mergers, that these CRA voluntary commitments and voluntary agreements are made and unilateral agreements mm-hmm. are made, why do they all seem to happen all around the time of a merger or expansion?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a key time for a bank. For example, CRA exams, 98% of the banks get outstanding and satisfactory. There's still differences in the grade where I still think even if you get an outstanding, you can do poorly in the state, and that could have, you're not going to go to the governor of West Virginia and say, hey, I got a low satisfactory in West Virginia, I want your deposits. So I still think there is still, CRA exams are still effective in holding banks accountable, but it's not quite the same thing as a merger application. A merger application is a very public process where the bank announces to the world, we are merging, and the regulatory agency has to approve that merger. Or denials are very, very rare, extremely rare. We actually have, on our testimony, we cite Federal Reserve statistics about how extremely rare a denial is. Nevertheless, the merger is, thankfully, it is a very public process. It's not only banks, but, you know, when Comcast wants to, you know, a cable company wants to acquire another cable company, that's a public process, too. Because this has very profound implications on society. You know, will there be sufficient competition after the merger? Will this be a good deal for communities and consumers? So, since it is a very public process, and, you know, banks are in the public reputation business, they want to make sure that, you know, frankly, they look good during the merger application. So, you know, that's why you get an impressive-sounding $1.5 trillion agreement. So what community groups thought it was a good thing to do is to say banks are asking for permission to do, they're asking permission from the government to massively expand. Before they allow to massively expand, we want to make sure that they're going to serve communities, number one, and then serve communities in a safe and sound way. If they're going to seek permission to go from half $300 billion to a $600 billion institution, that is profound for society. Therefore, it is incumbent upon both the regulator and the bank to make sure this is going to benefit society. And since this is a very public process, it's a process with, you know, if banks is totally, if powerful financial, even though powerful financial institutions are very powerful, there is something called moral suasion in our society. And if they just totally thumb their nose at it, thumb their nose at the process and say, you know, we know best, you know, we're not going to do anything, that won't fly. That won't be acceptable to people in the public and people in the public and banks somewhere else. And it should not be acceptable. So that is an opportunity to try to make sure in paper that banks are going to serve communities safely and soundly. And so that's why I hope it helps explain that mergers are a time of profound change in the financial industry, and the powerful are getting more powerful. So here is an opportunity, and it is, and that's why it is public and should always be public. But here is an opportunity to make sure these institutions are going to serve communities, and they should be held very much accountable.
Mm-hmm. Now you said this is an opportunity for banks to, I think, you, if I quote you right, and the transcript will reflect it, is look good. I think you said look good during the merger process. Look good for whom?
Well,
for the regulators.
Look good for the general public. When Bank of America's acquiring Countrywide, they're not going to say balloon mortgages, teaser rates that go from 6% to 16% in 2 years. We think these are good products. You know, we're going to continue. You know, we're going to continue doing these practices because these merger proceedings are publicly accountable. I think And the reason why it's public is very important. They're more likely to say, we are going to offer products that are safe and sound for communities, where people can pay on time. We're not going to hoodwink the consumer. Here are some promises on a piece of paper how these products are going to be safe and sound and not have these crazy teaser rates and not, you know, consume 70% of somebody's monthly income. Now, the problem was, part of the reason why we had the crisis is a lot of these products were made, there was not a public process to really scrutinize. You know, again, there wasn't a whole lot of merger activity, regulatory enforcement waned from 2003 to 2007, when you had the most usurious lending going on. If there was more public oversight and more transparency and more public merger proceedings and the regulators institute some more safeguards, I don't think we'd have the same extent of the crisis. So look good? Yeah, look good to the community in terms of serving people safely and soundly and fairly. I hope that answers the question. You know, we're going to continue offering teaser option arm loans that have 20% interest. It's more likely they're going to say, we're going to offer safe and sound and responsible lending products in the public proceeding.
Now, did banks have to have a good CRA record to gain regulatory approval for a merger or an acquisition?
They have to. Grandleach Bliley says that they cannot enter non-bank business, like, you know, acquire an insurance company, if they have a less than satisfactory rating. But in practice, the vast majority of large banks are interested in these non-bank activities, like acquiring insurance companies, have satisfactory and above ratings for all their subsidiaries. That's Grandleach Bliley. But you don't have to apply to the regulator to acquire an insurance company. So the merger process does not say you have to have satisfactory and outstanding for the federal regulator to approve the merger. But I can't think of a situation where a bank was going to acquire another bank and the acquirer was less than satisfactory.
But if the acquirer was less than satisfactory, you know, if they had an atrocious CRA record, do you think that merger would go through, or that acquisition would go through?
I've just never seen it. I've never seen a bank with a needs to improve. Those are the failing ratings, needs to improve or substantial noncompliance. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a bank with a needs to improve or substantial noncompliance receive a merger approval. Now, it may have happened, but I haven't seen it in my 15 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure. I don't think it should happen. You have failed to serve the public consistent with safety and soundness. Mm-hmm. You know.
Now, did the fact that banks had to have good or satisfactory CRA records to gain regulatory approval for mergers and acquisitions, did that give you any assistance or leverage in obtaining voluntary agreements or encouraging banks to do unilateral commitments?
The
fact that they had to have a good CRA record...
And the reason,
assist you in getting the voluntary commitment.
Well, you, Josh Silver, I don't...
You as the community group, or did it assist community groups in obtaining these commitments?
I would say no, Brad, because 98%, more than 98% of banks receive satisfactory and outstanding ratings. I don't think that has been a factor in merger applications, really.
What sort of interaction do community groups have with bank regulators concerning CRA or voluntary commitments or unilateral commitments? What sort of communications are there between community groups and the regulators over CRA and CRA-related issues?
Well, there's a lot of interaction between regulators and community organizations over CRA, but I think we went through a lot of this. You know, during these meetings with the bank and community groups before and during the merger application process, the regulators are not in the room. The community organizations will comment on their comments during the merger application process. We want something in writing from the bank committed to safe and sound lending, and then the regulators will carefully in their footnotes in the merger approval order saying CRA agreements are not, you know, part of the CRA regulation. We did not consider those comments in the community group letters. Now, outside of the merger application process, community organizations will have dialogue with regulators and say, this bank is doing this practice that we don't think is safe and sound. And then the regulator will talk to the bank, as it should.
Can you give us some examples in the CRA context of where that has happened?
Well, recently, some MCRC members have commented on CRA exams. The most recent comments have involved a bank making a much lower percentage of loans to African Americans or low and moderate income people than its competitors. And then in CRA, banks say to the regulators, we want you to examine us in these geographical areas. That's called assessment areas. And our community organization was concerned, this occurred in St. Louis, that the assessment area that was drawn arbitrarily excluded minority and low and moderate income neighborhoods, which by regulation the bank's not allowed to do. And that this maybe this configuration of the assessment area contributed to a very low level of loans to minorities and low and moderate income people. So the regulators are taking a look at the comments as it's doing its CRA exam of our member organization. And this is a very healthy thing to do, to make sure that the bank did not draw its assessment area in a way that discriminated against minority communities or low and moderate income communities, and to see if there's ways that the bank can increase its safe and sound lending to low and moderate income people and minorities.
And how powerful are objections by community groups to a merger or an acquisition? I mean, do you feel like, Josh, that the community groups have the appropriate voice with the regulators to object on grounds that banks aren't doing enough in terms of lending to minority or low-income persons?
Well, I think during the last eight, from about 2000 through now, we have seen very lackluster enforcement during the merger application process. And you can look at our testimony before the House Financial Services Committee over the years. For example, when Wachovia acquired World Savings, there was not a public hearing. World Savings was the largest adjustable rate mortgage lender probably in the world. There wasn't even a public hearing. There was nothing in the merger approval orders by the regulator saying, we are going to look carefully at your adjustable rate mortgage lending, and we want you to submit quarterly data on your adjustable rate mortgage lending. Or sometimes in the late 1990s, there would be a merger approval, but it would be a conditional merger approval. And we say, your merger's approved, but we want you to report to us about your safety and soundness and fair lending safeguards in your adjustable rate mortgage lending. That went away starting around 2000 to the present. You see no conditional merger approvals. So from the community's perspective, our voice is not being listened to, and there needs to be stepped up enforcement.
What sort of enforcement mechanisms exist that you think aren't being used?
Well, I think that the fact that 98% of the banks basically, quote-unquote, passed their CRA exams, it's time to reform and update the Community Reinvestment Act. If banks are going to get a pass, why don't we make the ratings more meaningful? Outstanding satisfactory is a very kind of blunt, those are kind of very blunt and broad grades. You know, you remember a report card. You could... You know, an 81% means something different, very different than, you know, a 94%, for example. So introduce more ratings. So if the bank's still going to pass, there's more meaning in the ratings.
But those are what you're describing, though, Josh. Aren't those new regulations or changes to existing regulations? My question, I guess, is what under the current regime mechanism, mm-hmm. under the current mechanisms that exist under the books now, are there that you feel are not being enforced to their fullest?
I think CRA. I do think that the ratings need to be reformed. So we are pursuing regulatory reform. I think that under the current regime, CRA exams could be tougher. We do see variations by geography, which is, I think, important. You can get, say, a low satisfactory a grade in one state. As I said to you before, it's much more effective if your bank trying to get business with the governor of West Virginia, say, we have an outstanding in West Virginia, then we have a low satisfactory rating in West Virginia. So I think tougher CRA exams and meeting out lower grades when warranted is an important thing to do. The regulators could also write comments in the CRA exam saying, you know, the bank's home lending performance was good, but we want the bank to make more small business loans in low and moderate income communities. Merger enforcement and merger application process, as I said, could be a lot more rigorous, like these conditional merger approvals. So I think even with the existing regulations, you could do a lot more with CRA exams and merger applications.
Were things different? Was enforcement stronger in the past, in the 90s?
I think from the mid to late 1990s was a period of stronger CRA enforcement, and then it relaxed.
Now let me ask you, there was a famous speech by Janet Reno when she was Attorney General about the Department of Justice role in ensuring that banks were giving loans to low and moderate income persons. Mm-hmm. Do you know which one I'm talking about, or are you familiar with that speech? I don't want to.
It may have been before our annual conference, but anyway.
I think it might have been. Uh-huh. In fact, what did that mean in terms of the number of voluntary commitments and voluntary agreements that came about as a result of her speech and the efforts of the Department of Justice in the 90s?
Well, I think in the 1990s, also in addition to the Department of Justice, merger enforcement was taken more seriously, and I think that did help increase the number of CRA agreements and commitments. I'll just say that very plainly. And I think that's a good thing when you get anti-predatory lending safeguards on a piece of paper. Now that I think that CRA enforcement has waned, you know, that's one reason you see fewer of these commitments. But, you know, I would not care if tomorrow there's not one more commitment. If we had tougher CRA exams and we had tougher merger enforcement, I think that alone could be very, very helpful in increasing the amount of responsible loans and investments in communities.
Before I leave this concept, and I appreciate your description here of how the process works, I want to ask a few more questions about just the process leading up to a merger or an expansion or an acquisition. Will the agreement that's reached, either it be a voluntary agreement or if it's a unilateral commitment, and forgive me if I use these interchangeably in this question, but whether it be in a voluntary agreement or a unilateral commitment, would those be reported by the bank to the Federal Reserve or the OCC during the merger process? Would this be something that the bank would say to the Federal Reserve or the OCC, look what we're doing. This just shows that we're a good institution and you should approve this merger or acquisition. Is that something that they
would... Well, yeah, when the Bank of America did this, you better believe it made its regulator know that it did that. Matter of fact, our community organizations would also send CRA agreements and commitments to the regulator during the merger approval process. And actually, you may be aware that there's something called CRA Sunshine. It's a legal requirement that if you're a community organization and you comment on the bank's CRA performance and you secure any sort of commitment or agreement above $10,000, whether it's a grant to a community organization or a commitment to loan $1.5 trillion to borrowers, you are required to submit those agreements to the federal agencies. Over the years, I think that those CRA, actually maybe I should print this out to you, for you. Over the years, I think that those submissions to the federal agencies have done nothing but collect dust in filing cabinets. But we looked at the first 2 years of the CRA agreement submitted by the required to be submitted by the CRA Sunshine law, and because there was an allegation, and it's resurfacing, community groups are extortionists. You know, they are calling banks all sorts of bad names because they want grants from the banks and they want to go vacation in Argentina. Former Senator Phil Gramm of Texas. CRA is slavery. You know, he said these things on the floor. He said these things on the Senate floor. But you know, community organizations do not request campaign contributions and from financial institutions and then run for Congress. So when we talk about extortion, let's be clear about what we're talking about. So anyway, we looked at the first 2 years of CRA agreements, and we found that less than 0.5% of the, it was a few billion dollars in the CRA commitments, less than 0.5% were grants to community organizations. So for extortionists, were pretty bad ones. That the whole idea of a CRA agreement, will the bank promise to make safe and sound home loans and small business loans and community development loans and investments in communities?
Help me understand something, though, and forgive me, I'm a little dense. And your explanations are helpful, but why are banks reporting this stuff? You know, I mean, when I ask you about do banks report it, you sort of said you better believe it that banks are reporting this to the regulators. I mean, why are they doing that if it doesn't help them with the merger? I mean, why are they sharing this information with the Fed and the OCC with pride and saying, look, we've done this commitment. Why are they doing that if it doesn't help them with the merger or the acquisition?
If they've made an anti-predatory lending safeguard promise in the CRA commitment, they certainly would want their regulators to know about it. Even though it officially does not, even though there's no official consideration of the CRA agreement in the merger application, it is a good thing that the bank has made an anti-predatory lending commitment. We'll say it promises a referral up program for anyone who promises a prime loan. It wants its regulator to know that.
But what about the Bank of America countrywide one? Why was Bank of America so interested in reporting that?
Well, you know, I don't know if that officially happened. You can do a Freedom of Information request and get all the documents that were part of that merger and see if they did submit the CRA agreement. I think it has happened when banks have submitted a CRA agreement. But you will see actually in the approval order that CRA agreements are not considered by the regulators, and that. The regulators say we look at CRA exams and we look at HMDA data and we look at, you know, CRA small business lending data to see what they've done in the past, and we don't look at future commitments. So you'll see that in merger approval orders.
Do banks promise the OCC that they'll honor the CRA commitments of the acquired institution? I mean,
it is in the corporate manual of the OCC, but I've never seen that. And remember, the footnote says is it will simply take the application off the expedited process. So from, you know, the change from a 15 day decision making period to like a 30 day decision making period. But I've never seen that in practice. So, you know, that should probably even be deleted from the footnote, but in the interests of complete transparency, it will stay there.
Just want to ask you about a few numbers that you have in the document. On page 8, there's a chart that lists the CRA dollar commitments in millions.
Mm-hmm.
And just going through the chart, it looks like 2004 was the high year of $1.6 trillion. The second highest looks like 1998 at $812 million. Mm-hmm. Third is 2003 at $711 million. Fourth looks like 2001 at $414 million.
And the billion, you mean?
$414 billion. Excuse mm-hmm. me, $414 billion on all these. And then the fifth was $258 billion in 2006. Mm-hmm. Point being, it looks like 2004 was the first year to mm-hmm. The highest.
Mm-hmm. Big merger year.
2003 was the third highest. Mm-hmm. 2001 was the fourth highest, and 2006 was the fifth highest. For this chart says dollar mm-hmm. commitments. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure I square that with what you said earlier about the fact that there were fewer and fewer commitments and more.
But even two commitments can equal, you know, what looks like an impressive dollar amount.
Okay. This chart, though, is the chart that's represented by this commitments. Are we talking about the voluntary agreements, or are we talking about unilateral commitments, or are we talking about both being represented
both.
In this chart?
And there's actually an Excel spreadsheet that does do it by state, but also it can be sorted by year. And actually, I believe that the FCIC has that Excel spreadsheet because I emailed it to you guys. So you can actually look by year and see what accounts for that $1.6 trillion, for example.
Did if it's not too much trouble, could you re-email that to us?
Yeah.
We have so many members of our staff. Sometimes things may get lost in the shuffle, but I look forward to seeing that. Mm-hmm. Similarly, Josh, if you have any other data on these CRA commitments, it would be useful for us to have. For instance, how many of these commitments? It's reported that. In the first page, page four, it says, since the passage of the CRA in 1977, lenders and community organizations have signed over 446 CRA agreements totaling more than $4.5 trillion. Mm-hmm. And then later it says, the chart below shows $4.5 trillion in CRA dollars was committed from 1992 through 2007. Do you have any data on whether these commitments have been honored, what percentage have been honored, what dollar amount have been honored?
That's actually extraordinarily, CRA agreements being honored, that's actually a very hard thing to estimate, and we have not done that. What we do know is a few years back, there were a couple of economists, Rafael Bostic, who used to be an economist at the Federal Reserve Board and now is the Director of Policy Development and Research at HUD, and his colleague Brett Robinson, who teaches at University of Delaware, they actually took a look at our database of CRA agreements. They actually spent a summer going through our CRA agreements file, which is actually sitting right there. You could get all the secrets if you walked away with a hard copy of file, and if you want to spend a summer in our conference room going through them, be my guest. We have nothing to hide. We believe in full sunshine and disclosure. But what Rafael Bostic and his colleague did is they looked at counties that had CRA agreements versus counties that did not, and they found that there was more lending in counties that had CRA agreements. This was before the heyday of subprime lending. This was really in the late 1990s. But they actually found after 3 years the effect sort of wore off. And so I cite that work in our congressional testimony, for example. So that's the closest that we have done to are these CRA agreements honored. We do see an effect of the CRA agreements. I should also add quickly that Harvard University, a joint center for housing, has also documented that impact with our CRA agreement database, but also where CRA exams, the geographical areas on CRA exams, the assessment areas I talked to you about, more safe and sound lending in the assessment areas than outside of the assessment areas. So that's actually why the number of geographical areas on CRA exams is very important.
Now, I note that page 8 is the summary chart of the commitments. How does the table on page 8 relate to the more detailed information on pages 11 through 14. Is this a...
Oh, 11 through 14 is your Excel database.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That and page 8 is, you know, aggregates the Excel database. So the Excel database on pages 8 through 11, and that's what I'm going to try to email you, has the CRA agreements by state, and then it has a total for each state, and then it also has a row that shows you the CRA agreements by year.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so what page 8 does is summarizes the information that you see on pages 11 through 14.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any Excel spreadsheets that do any sort of estimates on the number of commitments that have been honored, or do you have any of that, even if it's incomplete?
It's extraordinarily difficult research, and no. It's just... you actually would have to go to each of these banks and, you know, get their documentation, it's just takes a number of resources that's beyond the capacity of my organization.
Who follows up then to make sure that these banks honor their voluntary agreements or their unilateral commitments? I mean, who's following up to make sure that they're actually doing what they say they will do?
Well, actually, part of some of these CRA agreements was meeting with the bank two or three times a year and actually going through, here's what you promised, here's what you loaned. And that would happen with on a one-on-one basis with banks and community organizations. And that's the mechanism. I would actually love to see, you know, how much of this $1.5 trillion was actually honored. It's just, you know, just imagine, you know, you have 400 CRA agreements. I have myself and one other person that are researchers. You know, that's it. I don't have the resources to do that, to that type of study. I think it would be a great study to do.
We don't have much more staff.
I guess you don't.
We're all here.
But you have four. I have one.
You can tell I'm sitting next to a member of our research team when I ask about data. I've learned well from him to ask what data you have. What data do you have, Josh, with respect to the type of mortgages that were made with respect to CRA voluntary commitments or unilateral commitments? Do you have any data? Do you have a chart on these were X loans, these were Y loans? Do you have any sense on what?
I would love that. No, you don't know how many of them were fixed rate or adjustable rate mortgages, how many of them were prime or non-prime. But
you have no data on number of subprime?
No, but I tell you what, I think most of it is, we know, and the Federal Reserve research has demonstrated that banks complying with CRA make prime loans.
But
only six. I'll cite the Federal Reserve to you. Only 6% of all high-cost loans in the year 2006 were made by banks to low and moderate-income borrowers and considered on CRA exams. So only 6% of all the high-cost loans were actually considered on CRA exams. What that means is the great majority of subprime lending was done by independent mortgage companies. The majority of high-cost lending was done by independent mortgage companies. Banks were also doing some high-cost lending, but outside of geographical areas on their CRA exams. So when they were seeking CRA credit, they were making prime loans. Only 6% of all the high-cost loans in 2006 were considered on CRA exams.
Now the
and there's a whole lot of other research that demonstrates that CRA-covered banks complying with CRA were prime lending institutions. And so I would venture to say, I haven't done the research, but I would venture to say that the loans made under CRA commitments were basically your prime loans. And it's very consistent with research done by the Federal Reserve Board and others.
Now, when we're talking about subprime and prime, just to make sure we're talking about the same thing and talking apples to apples versus apples to oranges, when I think of subprime, I think in terms of FICO scores.
Mm-hmm.
Are you suggesting then that these mortgages were not made to people with under 660 FICO scores or 620 FICO scores, depending on which definition you use for prime and subprime? Or are you defining prime and subprime by the interest rate as opposed to the FICO score of the borrower?
I think that's a great question, and I wish I had the resources to research that. But my orienting hypothesis is that there are lots of low and moderate income people with FICO scores above 620 and 660 that receive these loans under CRA agreements. And that also another way to define a high-cost lending is the HMDA definition of high-cost lending, which from 2004 to 2008 for a first lien loan was an annual percentage rate, 3 percentage points greater than Treasury securities of comparable maturity. If you are getting a APR, 3 percentage points greater than Treasury securities of comparable maturity, chances are your FICO score is below 620. So I think that banks were indeed making prime loans to low and moderate income people with good credit scores. But, you know, be happy to, you know, as an impartial observer, it'd be interesting to be able to do that research. I think it's a very complex research to do.
Mm-hmm. Where would you go to do that research? If you had a bigger staff and you were doing that research,
let me ask the FCIC, because I actually understand from an industry source that you guys are asking banks for HMDA data. So what are you guys doing with your CRA inquiry? What are you guys doing?
Well, I'll decline to answer, unfortunately, Josh, because what we do is unfortunately, it's confidential until our report comes out.
But you've spent probably the last, you know, hour and a half asking me, you know, rather tough questions, and we know from the industry seems to know something about what you're doing. Why can't you tell us what you're doing?
Again, we'll have a report, and hopefully what we have in the report will be informative to the general public. But we ask for all sorts of data from various sources in order to protect, just like our conversation today, and the fact that we're talking to you is confidential, and what we talk about today is confidential unless and until the chair and the vice chair decide to make it public.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's confidential. Everything we do, our investigation, is confidential unless and until the chair and vice chair or the majority of the commissioners make something non-public. So mm-hmm. for me to comment on what we've requested or not requested from other institutions would be inappropriate. Just like if someone asked me, did you meet with Josh Silver, I couldn't answer that question. So I protect your privacy just as much as we protect other entities' privacy.
Did the trade association that gave us that lead violate any confidentiality?
I have no idea what trade association told you.
It was an industry trade association. If you're just collecting HMDA data, HMDA data is publicly available data. I don't know why you can't tell me that, yes, we are collecting HMDA data from financial institutions. Can you tell me in any general way what type of CRA inquiries that you are doing, and if you are going to be holding hearings or whatever, can NCRC testify at those hearings?
Well, first of all, I have no information one way or another to tell you in terms of what hearings we're going to have or not have. But you know, I'd refer you to Wendy Edelberg, our executive director, who might be able to shed some light in terms of what we have on our agenda ahead. I'm not in a position to.
Well, she actually said you guys would be talking to me, and that information would be discussed at this meeting. So, you know, whether you can tell me anything now or later, we would greatly appreciate it.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, from our standpoint, Josh, it's, you know, the more information we can get from you and other sources. We are a fact-finding commission, so we're trying to test hypotheses, ask tough questions, because tough questions get to answers.
Mm-hmm.
And we ask tough questions from banks. We ask tough questions from groups, independent groups. We ask tough questions from regulators. That's our job. So hopefully the questions haven't been too tough. But
I just feel like we're being extraordinarily forthcoming. And it would just be nice to have some reciprocity. So,
unfortunately, when you deal with any regulatory institution or congressional commission like we're dealing with, we're somewhat constrained until our final report is issued to the public.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you know, you don't want to try to reach or jump to any conclusions unless all the facts are in. So, if you don't mind, let's get back to some of the questions about the report, which I found was very detailed and informative. There's on page 10 of the report, there's a paragraph, the third paragraph down on page 10 says, this is talking about how the CRA commitments were calculated. The dollar amounts are based on commitments for community development lending, not the amount of lending that actually occurred. In some cases, the actual lending amount may exceed the dollar targets. In other cases, the dollar target may not have been met. In addition, many commitments are multi-year commitments that extend beyond 2007. Thus, it is important to remember that there is a substantial amount of CRA-related lending and investing that falls outside of the agreements documented in the study. First question is, what do you mean by that last sentence in terms of it's important to remember that there is a substantial amount of CRA-related lending and investing that falls outside of the agreements documented in the study? What's outside of the study? The study seemed to be very comprehensive, and I just want to understand what other CRA lending occurs outside of this report.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, Brad, I just emailed you CRA Sunshine reports and the actual Excel spreadsheet that you see in the report. So you can manipulate the spreadsheet, and you should be able to find the dollar totals in the Excel spreadsheet should match exactly the dollar totals by year that you see on page 8.
Great. Thank you.
And so on the CRA agreements, like we said before, we don't know. These are agreements and pledges, so we don't know how much of the promises actually were loaned or invested. So that's the first answer. The second answer is there is some 8,000 banks in the country, only really a very tiny minority of banks make CRA agreements. They tend to be the biggest banks in the country. But there is thousands of banks that don't enter into CRA agreements. So their lending and investing in services and compliance to CRA is not captured by CRA agreements. So relatively simple explanation.
and you've done a very nice job in categorizing and cataloging in this September 2007 report that you've done on CRA, and you pointed out that you don't have a very big staff. How was all this data compiled? How did you collect this information? How did you put this report together? What was your methodology for gathering the data?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think actually we describe it a little bit on page 10.
Mm-hmm.
You search for newspaper articles and other publications to see if CRA agreement activity is going on. You survey the members in your trade association, the community organizations in NCRC's coalition. In more recent years, since there's been such a drop-off in CRA agreements, I really know the handful of community organizations that have any possibility of securing a commitment. So that also, just knowing the field. But again, this publication hasn't been done since 2007, fall of 2007, and the major CRA commitment of any type after this publication was the Bank of America. So this publication has $4.5 trillion of commitments, and then you add the 1.5 for Bank of America to get 6.
And aside from the Bank of America one, do you have any list or an updated spreadsheet of the additional commitments that were made after the September 2007 report?
Nope. Okay. To be honest, didn't think it was relevant to continue the research. I might think it's relevant at some later date. Nothing to hide. Just didn't think it was relevant.
where do the mortgages, if we're talking about mortgages that are done, where do they go? In one part of the report, I noted that there were a sale of the loans. Page 22, this is describing on the top of page 22, the bullet, in its agreement with the Massachusetts Association of Community Development Corporations, Citizens Bank pledged to make $10 million in affordable home mortgage loans to new immigrants over a five-year time period starting in 1999. Mm-hmm. And then it picks up and says, Fannie Mae will purchase the loans. CRA agreement should, where possible, include commitments by secondary market institutions to purchase loans so that the banks can obtain more capital for making CRA loans. Was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac purchasers of the CRA mortgages that were made in many of these commitments?
Can't answer that question. Probably this was actually maybe a sentence written in the CRA agreement. Most CRA agreements will not specify in writing the involvement of the secondary market institutions, to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. That was actually probably rather unusual.
Are there other entities that are entities from which CRA loans may be purchased other than Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Are there other entities with which NCRC works with to purchase these mortgages?
Not to my knowledge.
What about what involvement or what interaction has the NCRC had with the GSEs, with Fannie and Freddie? Have you had communications with them or meetings in terms of the CRA loans that were being done with respect to commitments and agreements?
We have had meetings with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and at these meetings we asked them to support vigorously safe and sound lending to communities, not subprime junk. Over the years, it was HUD, now it's the Federal Housing Finance Administration, and whenever they asked for comments on affordable housing goals, and you can see our comment letters, we were very, very strong on saying that the anti-predatory lending protections proposed by HUD are not strong enough. That in around the year 2000, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac made some promises not to purchase loans with certain features. And we said, that's great, but we wanted HUD to go beyond those promises and include some additional anti-predatory safeguards, meaning that loans that exhibited features or owner's prepayment, for example, owner's prepayment penalties would not count towards goal fulfillment. More recently, the Federal Housing Finance Administration said that loans made in violation of the subprime and non-traditional guidance issued by the agencies, I believe it was 2006 and 2007, would not count towards affordable housing goals compliance. Those guidances are very, very weak. And we actually asked the Federal Housing Finance Agency, if you're going to use something, use the update to Regulation Z that the Federal Reserve Board issued in July of 2008, which is strong. It's still not strong enough, but stronger than the subprime and non-traditional guidance issued by the regulatory agencies. So that's where the community groups are coming from, that the GSEs should have strong anti-predatory safeguards in their activities.
What is the Community Capital Management, Inc.?
What is that?
Community Capital Management,
what
Inc.?
What page?
It's a note to myself. It's not on a page.
But oh.
Have you ever heard of an entity called the Community Capital Management Incorporated?
Mm-hmm.
What about a hedge fund or a private equity fund that has the name Community Capital Management?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
The only thing I know about hedge funds is Hank Paulson reading in the paper. I don't think that was his entity. I just don't remember.
I didn't know if you had any interaction with that fund.
NCRC and our member organizations are not involved with any nefarious hedge fund companies. Okay, tape recorder.
Is there a hedge fund or private equity fund in Florida that's involved in purchasing CRA mortgages or CRA securities?
It's not a hedge fund, but there is a fund in Florida. I don't know a whole lot about it, but NCRC is involved with it. It's just purchasing CRA, the related loans and investments. And there is a web page.
Uh-huh. And what is the relationship between NCRC and the fund? Is it affiliated with NCRC?
No, it's not affiliated. I think John Taylor has been on the board and is on their board. But, you know, the extent of my involvement, I don't even know the name of it.
And was there a gentleman named Irving Henderson that was involved with that?
Yep. I believe he's on their board, too. Mm-hmm.
And this was a fund, though, that was designed to purchase CRA mortgages? Or what was the purpose of the fund? I'm just trying to understand the connection here.
It is to purchase or to facilitate financing that qualifies for CRA. And it's to help banks pursue projects that help promote affordable housing. Nothing sinister, affordable housing, economic development, small business development in low and moderate income communities, investments and loans, it finances investments and loans. And to my knowledge, John Taylor and Irvin Henderson are on their board. Dave, my colleague David, probably knows the name of the organization. If it's helpful, I can see, you know, maybe after you ask all your questions, if David's around, if we can ask him for the name of that institution.
Mm-hmm. A couple questions that let's just take page 4. There's a statement in here just at the top taken. CRA agreement is a pledge signed by community organizations and a bank outlining a multi-year program of lending, investments, and or services. While the bank provides the loans and investments specified in the agreement, the community group frequently assists the bank in assuring the success of CRA-related products and services, community groups sometimes help in marketing and provide financial counseling and other services. Aside from what's in the parenthetical, how does the community group assist the bank in assuring the success of the CRA-related products?
I think exactly what the parenthesis says, that some of the community organizations, for example, are housing counseling organizations, and they'll provide counseling, and people who graduate from the counseling are eligible to receive affordable mortgages from the institution negotiated the CRA agreement in other banks. So to be honest, that's probably an overstatement. I really don't know how often that happens. It does occur, and I think it's an example of win-win collaboration. More business for the bank, more safe and sound lending for communities.
Mm-hmm. There's a statement in here on the second paragraph on page 4 about the application process, and it's describing the application process to merge or expand services. The application process, therefore, provides an incentive for lenders to sign CRA agreements with community groups that will improve their CRA performance. Square that with what we were talking about earlier in terms of CRA agreements don't count for purposes of mergers, yet this seems to suggest that it will improve their CRA performance and therefore it counts some way. What did you mean by that statement? The application process therefore provides an incentive for lenders to sign CRA agreements with community groups that will improve their CRA performance?
Well, I think we've sort of been around this, and I'll just repeat that if there's an anti-predatory lending safeguard that's on paper, I think it's a good thing for the bank to say to its regulator, we have committed to this anti-predatory lending safeguard, and sometimes the regulator, without reference in the CRA agreement, will say this bank has agreed to this anti-predatory lending safeguard. For the general public, for newspapers, when a bank says that it's made a $1.5 trillion agreement, that makes the bank look good in the eyes of the public. And maybe that's a good thing. I think it's, you know, hooray for Bank of America saying we're going to lend $1.5 trillion to low and moderate income people over 10 years. And our community organizations want to make sure that lending's safe and sound.
And how do you ensure that in terms of safe and sound? Bank makes a commitment to do X billion or trillion dollars of mortgages. How do you ensure that they actually are issuing mortgages that are safe and sound?
You do the best you can. You go to meetings with the bank and you say, can you provide us documentation that your lending is safe and sound? Can you provide us a checklist? You know, do you do no income documentation loans? Do you have prepayment penalties? Do you have teaser rates? You know, our community groups have tried to, you know, go down the laundry list of these features that are problematic and ensure that the banks don't not offering these loans that have these conditions. And sometimes the bank will provide detail, and other times they will not. You know, this is a personal anecdote. My wife says to me, "You are to blame for the financial crisis. You knew what to do, but you couldn't get Congress to do it." You know, look, Brad, you know, we're community organizations. And if we ruled the world, we would not be having a foreclosure meltdown, because we would have made sure that banks were safe, were making banks and other financial institutions were making loans that were safe and sound. And, you know, again, the financial institutions who were making bad loans were non-regulated institutions. There were mortgage companies and Wall Street investment firms financing the mortgage companies. They were not covered by CRA. You know, I tell you that anecdote because I think, you know, community groups are very frustrated because we have been saying in so many different ways we want financial institutions to make safe and sound loans, and a lot of institutions did not. And this was not only a crisis in America, but it was a global. It became a global crisis, as we know. And it's such a tragedy because it all could have been prevented if there was some stronger stronger law and regulatory enforcement. The best you can do to make sure that banks are making safe and sound loans under CRA agreements is you have meetings with them, and you see what data they can give you.
And did the NCRC have those meetings as well? Did you participate, you meaning the NCRC, in meetings with banks and other lenders?
Not specifically on CRA agreements, but sure. We talked about banks and other lenders about what anti-predatory safeguards do you have in your lending products. And I just remember, and I think about some of these meetings so sadly, because I do remember sometimes some of the trade associations that represented subprime lenders saying to us, "We are not doing single premium credit insurance. We have these safeguards and prepayment penalties," but they were not telling us about all this crazy option arm lending that they were doing. So we thought around 2001, 2002, gee, we're making some progress. You know, they're not doing single premium credit insurance. And then you turn around 4 or 5 years later and you say, "Well, they're just lying through their teeth." Because they discontinued the single premium credit insurance, but there's a whole other host of abuses that they were starting to do, and they weren't telling us. It's very sad.
There have been statements and allegations by that I've read in the media that CRA loans were not safe and sound. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to that? What sort of data do you have that we can see and point to address that allegation, whether CRA loans were safe or sound?
Well, in this publication, those copies for you, there's a quote from, I think the Federal Reserve does some excellent research. There's a quote from Sandy Bronstein saying that CRA... loans are safe and sound, and let me find another document that I will email to you.
What sort of data do you have, though, Josh? I mean, I'd like to be able to point to data, as a researcher investigator, and say this data shows, you know, refutes that or supports that allegation. Mm-hmm. What sort of data do you have that we could see or you could share with us. And I'm familiar with the Fed study as well, mm-hmm. but if there's anything else that you may have collected or you know of out there, would appreciate seeing that.
Well, we have a document, it's called Refuting Common Criticisms of CRA and CRA Modernization Legislation. It goes through a lot of the research documenting that CRA lending is safe and sound, a lot of the Federal Reserve research. For example, Federal Reserve Bank of researchers at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco found that CRA covered loans were about half as likely to go into foreclosure as loans issued by independent mortgage companies. So you'll see that in this document and in congressional testimony I'll share with you, along with a quote from Ben Bernanke himself. Mm-hmm. So, shoot, if you don't believe NCRC, I think that the Federal Reserve Board carries some weight.
The more information that you have, the more data, the better.
Mm-hmm.
We are connoisseurs of data and information, and given our short time frame, mm-hmm. the more that you can share with us, the better.
Mm-hmm. I have sent you emails with gobs of documents, and we'll do so in the future.
That'd be great. You can never send us too much, I can assure you of that.
Don't lose them.
We won't. Page 5, there's a statement in there on the last paragraph about large banks and thrifts make multi-state agreements with networks of community groups that tailor the lending and investing to fit local needs. NCRC encourages lending institutions to work closely with community groups so that multi-state agreements include subtotals by state, which address credit and capital needs of major metropolitan areas, as well as rural communities. Couple questions about that. One is, how does the NCRC encourage lending institutions to work closely with community groups? What did you have in mind when you wrote that statement?
We talked to staff of major lending institutions, and we say, work closely with the community groups, so multi-state agreements include subtotals by state. One problem we have with the with these types of things is $1.5 trillion. What geographical areas? You know, it's just, you know, it's very nonspecific. You know, what is Bank of America going to do in Texas and North Carolina, South Carolina, West Virginia, for example? That's all.
And are you following up with Bank of America to get some more specificity on their $1.5 trillion commitment?
No. And the reason for that is after September 2007, I mean, we've spent about 2 hours talking about CRA agreements, and I know why you've asked me all these questions about CRA agreements, but that's not where the effort is right now, because it is so hard to get CRA agreements. We are just helping NCRC member organizations right now. How do you make a comment on the CRA exam? When there is a merger application, it's so infrequent now, but when there is a merger application, helping NCRC members comment on merger applications. When a bank's about to close a branch, what can we do to either prevent a closure of the branch or to pursue alternatives? That's come up a few times recently. And just, you know, regular... Every bank in this country has a CRA officer, and just working with community organizations, whether it's a community development corporation that's building houses or a housing counseling organization, helping them approach a bank and saying, hey, do you want to team up on this program or this, can we help you market your product in minority communities? So CRA agreements is not where the action is at. Where the action is at is, can we help our members prevent a branch closure? Can we work with our members to comment on CRA exams? Or it's actually what happens probably more frequently, can we just help our members? They have a meeting next week with a bank CRA officer. Can we help our members, prepare for that meeting?
I noticed that the four large institutions, Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo, accounted for quite a few of the commitments in here. They seem to be the top four lending institutions behind the commitments. Are they providing reporting information to you? Are they sharing data with you?
No.
On CRA agreements? Nope.
What about unilateral commitments?
Nope. It's not where the action is.
I mean, even on...
Charge server. Hi. Okay. I'm in a meeting, so what? Can I help you quickly? How late will you be in the office? Okay. What's your extension, Michelle? I don't remember. 7705. Okay. Yep, bye-bye. Sorry.
What sort of communication do you have with Bank of America, Citigroup, JPMorgan Chase, and Wells Fargo? How often are you talking to them? How often are they talking to you?
I have very minimal communication. NCRC, and we state this publicly, has a Bankers Community Collaborative Council, which involves representatives from those institutions and other large lending institutions, and members of our board of directors, which are community organizations. And the Bankers Community Collaborative Council meets roughly quarterly and discusses policy, legislative developments, regulatory developments, and bank products and practices. No CRA agreements are negotiated at these meetings. And many times, especially on the regulatory and legislative discussions, we agree to disagree respectfully. Mm-hmm. I've been in a few of those, but not recently.
You talked briefly about the voluntary pledges, I think, but I wanted to make sure that I have all my terminology right. On page 6, there's a paragraph that states, a significant trend has been the increase of large voluntary pledges by banks starting in the late 1990s and continuing to...
I'm sorry, say this again today. This is top of page six.
First sentence there. A significant trend has been the increase of large voluntary pledges by banks. When you refer to large voluntary pledges, are you referring to the same thing as unilateral commitments?
Yes.
Okay. When we say voluntary pledges, that's synonymous with unilateral commitment?
See, what are the categories that we used here? Yeah, agreement is something that's signed between the bank and community organization. Voluntary pledges are these unilateral commitments.
Okay.
The whole thing is voluntary, so maybe the terminology should have been different.
What role does NCRC or community groups then have in the voluntary pledges? Is it same with the unilateral commitments?
Yes, we've been through that. Yeah.
Okay,
same
got
thing.
It. There have been reports about community groups demonstrating on bank mergers, demonstrating on acquisitions and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Does that assist in inducing banks to make commitments?
Probably not, actually. And that's actually not a technique that's commonly used by NCRC members, and hasn't been used by NCRC members to secure agreements.
Help me understand that, if you could. Just a typical, and if you've got a real life example, you could walk us through. That'd be great. Or if you want to talk hypothetical, that's fine as well. But you know, Bank A wants to acquire Bank B. Big bank wants to acquire Bank B. Circa 2004 or 2005. What would be the involvement of the community groups? When? How would they get involved? How would the process work toward working either toward a voluntary agreement signed by the parties or leading up to something like a unilateral commitment or a voluntary pledge? What would be the chronology there? Just help me understand how this works.
There's a series of meetings between the banks and the community organizations, and sometimes those meetings result in a memorandum of understanding, and sometimes those meetings do not. Sometimes those meetings result in a unilateral commitment that is oftentimes comes at the surprise of NCRC member organizations. But hasn't been that often recently.
Let's take 2004, though. Then it gets reported in the press that Acme Bank wants to acquire Beta Bank. Does NCRC then read this and someone here work with the community group and then meet with the bank? Does the community group read this, contact you? Does NCRC just have no involvement and then the community group? Does it vary? Do you have an example that you can talk us through
Brad, all I can say is that there are meetings between our NCRC member organizations and banks, a series of them, because these things are complicated, and negotiations are complex, and sometimes agreements are made, sometimes they're not. During these merger applications, NCRC will help our community organizations analyze the home loan data and the small business data that's publicly available. And we have helped our members figure out what types of goals should we be asking for CRA agreements. We're not involved in negotiations, but we have, if the bank is making 10% of its prime loans to African Americans and its competitors are making 20%, maybe you should try to get the bank to make 15 to 20% of its prime loans to African Americans. So we do provide technical assistance on, in a very quantitative way, what would be an improvement in the bank's lending. We have had conference calls with our member organizations during these merger applications. It hasn't happened in a few years. But, our New Jersey members will tell other NCRC members in other states what the bank said to the New Jersey members, and in other states, the Illinois groups will report on what the bank said. And, of course, we're trying to help our banks negotiate the best deal for safe and sound lending for communities. And short of CRA agreements, because we knew that most of the times they actually were not going to happen after about 2004. Short of CRA agreements, what other things are we looking for? Are we looking for the regulators to do conditional merger approvals? What things would we like to see? The referral up programs was something that was often discussed. So I hope that that's all I can really tell you.
Tell me about conditional merger approvals.
Hasn't happened since about 1998.
Have you tried to get any since 1998?
Sure. They don't do them.
What is a conditional merger approval?
We've talked about this before. Your merger is approved, but you will have to report to us about your anti-predatory lending safeguards on a quarterly basis. Your prime lending to low and moderate income people is low. We want to see measurable progress to improving your prime lending to low and moderate income people. I haven't seen that probably since the late 1990s, and that was very rare.
Can you elaborate on any times that you sought a conditional merger approval since 1998 and didn't get it? Can you tell me some examples of where you or a community group or one of your members may have sought that? Any big mergers? Any big acquisitions?
I think all of them, but it just doesn't happen. We asked the regulators to, oftentimes community groups ask the regulators to have various safeguards in the approval orders. And Wachovia World Savings didn't happen. Bank of America Countrywide didn't happen. In the Countrywide, it was really the only enforcement was by state attorney generals. And now there's people, now there's powerful lawmakers that want to preempt state anti-predatory lending laws. Not too helpful when AGs were the only cops in the beat.
For a long time.
I hope we're winding down.
Yes, I'm finished with my questions, but I've hogged up all the time. It's been fascinating, though, Josh, and we appreciate your time. and continued cooperation with us. Karen, I think Karen had a few questions.
Sure, I just have a couple questions. I was reading, I brought a copy for you, but I was reading the San Francisco Fed and the Boston Fed's report from 2009. I think you wrote an article in it, but this is one,
yep.
This is one of the articles from mm-hmm. it, and it's the banker's perspective on the CRA.
It certainly is.
And I was just curious about your perspective on a couple of the comments that were made in it.
Mm-hmm.
In one part of his article...
By the way, that the study done by a San Francisco Fed economist, Carolina Reed, talking about CRA loans are much less likely to go into foreclosure is in this publication. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no problem. In one part, it talks about how after the 1995 rewrite of the regulations, there was more focus on more of a quantitative checklist for making the CRA loans for the CRA ratings, and it said that this focus on numbers spilled over into the CRA commitments. I'm just going to read a quote from it. The increased emphasis on dollar and unit volumes can be seen in the significant jump in the size of pledges made by a number of banks. For example, in the 1995 Chase Chemical merger to the 2004 merger with Bank One, the size of the commitments rose 40-fold from $18.1 billion over 5 years to $800 billion over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
However, this larger number mainly reflected the inclusion of additional types of loans rather than any significant growth in their specialized core community development programs.
Okay.
I was just curious about that last part. Did you feel that the change in the commitments over time was more just the inclusion of more loan products as opposed to higher volumes of commitments?
Well, what he's talking about is just an individual home loan for, say, a low and moderate income person versus more specialized community development products. These could be a loan for a shopping center development in a low and moderate income neighborhood. And he's saying that CRA agreements started to count a lot more, these individual home mortgage loans. I sort of say, so what? He makes a point in that article that CRA-related loans are more costly for institutions that loan than loans to rich people. All loans have marketing and underwriting costs. I don't know. He actually has an $8,000 figure. I don't know where he gets that. The research that I've seen doesn't have anything of similar magnitude, and actually we've been in conferences and I've asked him and he's never really answered that question. Probably loans to low and moderate income people are in a sense quote unquote a little more costly because the underwriting might take about the same amount of time, but you're making a loan of $50,000 versus a loan of $700,000. So of course it might be more profitable to make the $700,000 loan. But it's not unprofitable to make the $50,000 loan. And eventually the market for Cadillacs will get saturated and you do have to make loans and you do have to sell the Chevys, for example. I question some of the costs that he's citing, in that article. And he's sort of making the suggestion that loans that the loan market in low and moderate income communities became saturated. And I don't think that's true because you had a lot of bad lending in those communities, a lot of these exploding non-traditional loans. And instead, if financial institutions had made more safe and sound loans, in other words, a lot of that demand that was satisfied by this toxic lending could have been satisfied by safe and sound lending. So that's another point of contention. Another debate that I've had with him, about that assertion. So
related to that point, for the CRA obligations that the banks were required to fill, they could either originate loans or purchase loans that fulfill the CRA commitments, or sorry, not the CRA commitments, but that fulfill the CRA terms. Do you know for CRA commitments, could they purchase loans from other institutions, or were the CRA commitments generally to originate specific loans?
When I think about the commitments, I think about in terms of originations and not purchases so much. But on CRA exams, we are aware of, and there's actually in the there's an interagency question and answer document that say banks should not game CRA exams by purchasing loans shortly before the exams and then selling them. And we've actually said to the regulators over the years, you should account originations more than purchases. So that has been an issue over the years. We actually do want improvements in that area.
Do you know within the voluntary CRA commitments whether they could purchase loans or if that was specified within the commitments? When they set out to fulfill them, or since they... I'm just wondering whether it was spelled out or not.
I don't think in a lot of the cases it is spelled out. I think the CRA agreements have resulted in more safe and sound lending to low and moderate income communities because of the Raphael Bostic study I mentioned to you earlier, for example. That Woodstock Memorandum of Understanding, I mean, I think it's really talking mostly about originations.
Okay.
But anyway.
Okay.
Fifth. Wrong.
I'm good.
Fifth.
Do you guys lobby Congress at all?
We advocate before Congress and the federal regulatory agencies to improve the anti-predatory laws and regulations and to update and improve the Community Reinvestment Act. This brochure that I've given you is promoting the Community Reinvestment Modernization Act of 2009, which would improve CRA. The answer is, quote unquote, yes, we lobby Congress, but to improve the laws against abusive lending and to promote CRA.
Underwriting standards. I noticed on page 19 in your 2007 report, you mentioned underwriting standards such as credit history and employment, income source, obligation ratios, and whatnot. They're listed as potential subjects for CRA commitments.
Mm-hmm.
How would they be factors to an agreement?
Let's see. There might be some examples in here, but we want to make sure that the ability of the borrowers to repay a loan is adequately considered. The bank shall rigorously consider the borrower's ability to repay a loan. Believe it or not, lenders weren't doing that. It would be nice to have them, you know, so Congress is part of the Financial Regulatory Reform Bill. The House's anti-predatory lending title is now part of the conference committee-based text.
Just.
And there's lots of provisions about ability to repay. So, you know, what community groups are trying to do was trying to pursue some of those prudent underwriting standards in CRA agreements.
So you were trying to increase obligation ratios, decrease?
No, not increase them. Make sure that the borrower had ability to repay the loan. Not get banks to do 70% debt to income ratio lending. No, the exact reverse.
Right. Okay. And credit history. How would NCRC weigh in on credit history?
The FICO score is one way to evaluate credit history. We were also encouraging banks to look at somebody who doesn't have a credit history, doesn't have credit cards.
Right.
Did they pay the rent on time? Did they pay utility bills? And there were some of those products in the mid to late 1990s, but that type of consideration, I just don't remember the last 5 or 8 years. If you paid your rent for 10 years straight and you were never late, and your mortgage...
Wouldn't that be credit history?
Yeah, but it would not necessarily be a FICO score, because you really have to have a credit card, have credit cards to have FICO scores.
Okay, so you would want that
to be considered,
rather than credit history or a FICO
If you didn't have credit cards, you wouldn't have a FICO score.
Okay.
So how can we get somebody who actually was very carefully managing their finances into a home if the lender was only using FICO score, but they paid their rent for 10 years. And the mortgage, by the way, this is in Indianapolis, it's not in San Francisco. And the mortgage, by the way, wouldn't be very much more than the rental payment. So that's the idea.
It hasn't escaped me that you said, you know, safe and sound lending several times during the interview. FICO score, probably
a few hundred times.
FICO scores, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of history, there's a lot of studies that say FICO scores are a pretty good indicator of whether somebody's going to default or not. Do you have studies on something like, you know, payment history of the utility or something about how reliable they are?
No. But matter of fact, I do remember several years ago that the studies show that low and moderate income people, I believe, had the same or better FICO scores than middle and upper income people, because they would be less cavalier about missing a payment. And I think I remember Fair Isaac having some of those studies. But yeah, just think of it. You know, if someone's paying their rent 10 years straight, never late on a rental payment, they don't have a credit card. The mortgage in Indianapolis is not much more than the rent, maybe not even more than the rent at all. I think that person qualifies for a home loan.
The vast majority, I guess, of those people suffering foreclosure have been maybe some of NCRC's targeted LMI families. Are you guys?
I don't think that's true.
No.
I mean, you look at the Federal Reserve memo where they have that famous 6% figure. And they actually look at foreclosure rates in low and moderate income neighborhoods and the neighborhoods right above the CRA threshold of 80% low and moderate income.
Mm-hmm.
And the foreclosure rates are basically the same.
So you're not seeing an increase of foreclosures in low and moderate income neighborhoods?
Well, you know, look at the Federal Reserve memo. They didn't. You know, right below the CRA threshold and right above the CRA threshold. Foreclosure rates are very similar.
So you see them as being static, foreclosures being static in low to moderate income neighborhoods?
I think foreclosure rates have probably increased in both communities over the years, but what I'm saying is the Federal Reserve research, and I will share that memo with you. It's a memo from Glenn Kanner. And it has that 6% figure, and then it also has that foreclosure rate analysis.
Well, I think we're out of time.
Mr. Silver, if I could take you up on your offer for one thing. You were kind enough to offer, I thought, the opportunity to look at some of the information that you have. And would it be possible to, and we're happy to come over and make copies ourselves, or if they're on electronically, to see the CRA agreements or unilateral commitments of the four big banks since 2000. By that I mean Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Bank of America.
Yes, one of your staff can come back and go through the filing cabinets. I'll show you what the copying machines are, and you can make copies.
That'd be great. We appreciate that. And as I alluded to during the interview, our process, our interview process, is confidential unless and until the commission acts to make it otherwise. So we would ask that you don't discuss what we talked about today with anyone, and maintain that in confidence.